Well, a significant portion of the world recognizes and celebrates yesterday as a religious holiday commemorating the birth of Christ. To illustrate a little bit how pervasive that is, as I was preparing for this talk, the online Bible resource that I used opened to the verse of the day, which was the birth announcement of the angel to the shepherds recorded in Luke 2. So in many churches today, it would not be unusual to experience a special service recognizing the day. Unfortunately, if you came here expecting that, you may be disappointed. In fact, you're even getting an amateur up here to do the talk this morning. But we are gathered this morning not to celebrate the birth of the baby Jesus, but in recognition and remembrance of his death and rebirth. The Bible does record the details of Jesus' birth, although the date is unknown. But more importantly for us, the Bible makes no mention of nor provides an example of celebrations among the early Christians recognizing Christ's birth. God's Word does, however, record for us the weekly memorial, remembering Christ's sacrifice for us, which is the example that we're following this morning. But the Bible does record details of Jesus' birth, and that is provided, like everything else in the Bible, for our edifications. So it's worthy to reflect on that, and this seems as good a time as any for such a reflection. And as we sometimes sing, Jesus' birth is best described as lowly, as recorded in Luke 2, beginning in verse 4. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. And while they were there, the time came for her to give birth. And she gave birth to her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger, because there was no place for them in the inn. Mary gave birth to Jesus in a place reserved for animals, because his parents were unable to find suitable lodging. And instead of a crib or a bed, he was laid in the animal's feed trough. It is hard to imagine a more lowly birth. Compare that to a future king of this world. So Prince George is the eldest son of Prince William, and potentially a future king of England. Well, imagine what it was like at his birth, and all the comforts and care and people caring for him. And contrast that with our king's arrival here on earth. Well, later, when Mary and Joseph offered the required sacrifice, consecrating Jesus to the Lord, they offered two turtle doves. Well, the two turtle doves were the substitute sacrifice for the poor unable to provide a lamb. Our King, Jesus, was also born into poverty. His entry in the world provided a preview of his life of sacrifice while here on earth. And it began the fulfillment of the prophecy of Isaiah 53. Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Literally nothing about Jesus' early life was anything that we would imagine a king's life to be. Well, shortly after his birth, the trials continued. King Herod sought to find Jesus and kill him. God, as he has done throughout the Bible, intervened, and he directed Joseph to take his family to Egypt. Jesus and his family were poor, and now they were exiled in a foreign land. After Herod's death, it was safe to return. Yet Joseph still could not take his family home for fear of their safety, and they ended up in Nazareth, presumably without the benefit of the family that Joseph had known. So Jesus' young life was apparently as part of a family forced to start with little, away from any relatives that would be able to provide support. Again, that does not sound like the life of a future king. Jesus would eventually acquire the skills of a carpenter, which he apparently used to support himself prior to beginning his ministry. Well, carpentry is certainly a worthy profession, but certainly not something that a modern-day future king would have to do to make a living. And I don't know about you, but I don't know any rich carpenters. Jesus was born in a manger to poor parents, exiled in a foreign land while the powerful sought to kill him, settled in a town away from his parents' home, forced to learn a trade to support himself. This provides a description of a great portion of the first 30 years of Jesus' life. And now the sorrows start, and he becomes the man of sorrows of which Isaiah spoke. His ministry began with his baptism by John the Baptist, and almost immediately, he endured 40 days in the wilderness without food, having to endure temptations from the master of tempters, Satan. After resisting Satan, Jesus returned to a life of homelessness, as he tells us in Luke 9:58, when he is proclaiming to someone his wish to become a follower of Jesus, Jesus responds, "Foxes have dens, and birds of the sky have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to rest his head." This sense of Jesus' homelessness pervades the Gospels. He really has no home base of operations. He's constantly on the move with his disciples, forced to count on the hospitalities of their families or others. If there's any geographical center of gravity to his ministry, it is Jerusalem, and that's where he's crucified. In fact, Jesus received no honor in his home. He was even rejected in his own town of Nazareth, as he tells us in Mark 6:4, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his relatives and in his own household. In fact, as Luke records, the people of Jesus' hometown were so angry, they sought to throw Jesus off a cliff. Probably even sadder for Jesus, Luke records that he was unable to do great works in his hometown because of their unbelief. Well, imagine for a minute if you had the power to do something wonderful for your family and neighbors. Let's say cure them of COVID or prevent them from getting COVID. Well, how sad it would be if the only people that you couldn't help would be the neighbors that you grew up with. And yet Jesus, with his mighty power, was faced with this in his hometown because of their unbelief. Jesus' sadness towards his home base of Jerusalem is recorded on at least two occasions. First, in Luke 13:34, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing." Jesus' desire while he's here on earth is to help and save people. He loved people, and he loved the people of Jerusalem as he loved all people, and he wept over Jerusalem because of their unbelief, as Luke records later in chapter 19. Jesus faced unbelief throughout his entire ministry, even from his followers. He was laughed at when he claimed that Jairus' daughter was only sleeping immediately before he raised her from death. When Lazarus died, the Jews had no faith, and it grieved Jesus' heart. Instead of having faith that he could raise the dead, they criticized Jesus for allowing him to die in the first place. It seemed that no matter how many miracles Jesus performed, and how many people he healed, and how many good things he did to help others, the crowd always criticized him, demanding more miracles, questioning his word and his deity, as John records in John 12:37. "Though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him." No matter what Jesus did to open the eyes of his people, the Jews, they always came back wanting more proof. Later in John 12, we learn that even those that did believe, many of those that did believe, refused to acknowledge it because of their desire for the approval of man. As John records in 12:42, Nevertheless, many even of the authorities believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. How sad Jesus must have been for their souls. Still, as frustrating as it would have been that Jesus faced unbelief from the various people that he met during his ministry, even more disappointing would be the unbelief that Jesus faced from his own family and closest followers. Even his own brothers did not believe in him, demanding that he risk his life in Judea and go and openly show his works. Jesus spent more than 3 years traveling with his disciples, where they were witness to all the signs and miracles that he performed. But even they failed to recognize Jesus' deity through his death and burial. John records Philip's question following some of Jesus' teaching on the night before his crucifixion in chapter 14, verses 8 and 9. Philip said to him, "Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us." Jesus said to him, "Have I been with you so long, and you still do not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'?" That last phrase illustrates Jesus' deep disappointment. How, after all this time, can you not believe that I am he? The unbelief of Jesus' disciples extended to their disbelief in reports of him being alive following his death on the cross. As Mark records in chapter 16, verses 9 through 14, "Now when he rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out 7 demons. She went and told those who had been with him, as they mourned and wept. But when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they would not believe it. After these things, he appeared in another form to 2 of them, as they were walking into the country. And they went back and told the rest, but they did not believe them. Afterward, he appeared to the 11 themselves, as they were reclining at table, and he rebuked them for their unbelief and hardness of heart, because they had not believed those who had seen him after he had risen." Well, no doubt Jesus' disciples still loved Jesus, even in their unbelief. And many of the unbelieving Jews carried no animosity towards him. But others were so threatened and offended by Jesus that they sought to kill him. This began shortly after his birth, when Herod sought to kill him. But even before his death on the cross, Jesus was forced to conduct his entire ministry with caution, being careful where he went, taking care to avoid the people and areas that were eager to capture and kill him. So we have Jesus traveling the land, focused on good works of healing and teaching, and all the time having to worry about people wanting him dead. Well, eventually, at the chosen time, Jesus would have to face the cruel death on the cross. His agony over the impending events was apparent as he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane. Immediately after this, the betrayal and the abandonment begins. Jesus is betrayed with a kiss. That's indicative of the betrayal by a close personal relationship. His disciples flee. Jesus has to personally witness the denial of Peter. Then the Jews, his own people, cry out for his crucifixion. He's mocked while he's hanging from the cross. First, the Jewish authorities. Then he's mocked by the Roman soldiers. And then he's mocked by one of the common criminals with whom he was crucified. Jesus came to earth to live as a man. In the end, every human relationship that Jesus experienced was severed. First, those of his local community, then those of his friends and followers, his people, the ties of nationality were severed. And in the end, he loses his own mother when he entrusts Mary to John. Finally, he experiences a feeling of abandonment by God. To feel abandoned by God when one has known him is certainly the worst imaginable spiritual torment. In many ways, a natural reaction to Jesus' life on earth is, what a miserable life. A lowly birth, born into poverty, exiled as a child, homeless, tempted, doubted by his family, closest friends and associates, a wanted man constantly on the run from the authorities, despite only wanting and striving to do good for his people. And in the end, he was abandoned by all who knew him, and even his God, and forced to suffer the cruelest death imaginable. And he did this willingly. Jesus willingly left heaven for this. Probably on more than one occasion, I've mentioned that one of the things that I really appreciated about Adam's teaching was that he routinely asked us to consider what it would be like to be in heaven. The Bible tells us that it is beyond our ability to comprehend the totality of being in the presence of God's glory. 1 Corinthians 2:9, but as it is written, what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him. Still, we know from the Bible that it will be far, far above even the most privileged life here on earth. Revelations 21:4. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more, and neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. Jesus knows this. In Luke 23:43, he says to the believing person that was crucified with him, truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. So Jesus willingly and knowingly left his seat of authority in an unimaginable paradise. He did that to live a life filled with tribulation and sorrow. And he did it willingly, and he did it with foreknowledge of the events that were to occur. So why did he do this? As we sang, he did this out of his love for us. Jesus loves us so much that he willingly endured a life filled with sorrow that ended in the cruelest death imaginable, so that he could provide for us what he knew already existed, that the passage from Revelation that I just read describes, so that we can gain a victory that leads to no more tears or mourning or pain. So let's reflect on Jesus' sacrifice on behalf of our victory in the end while we partake of the Lord's Supper this morning.